I want to raise a point about what I call the propedeutic nature of physical knowledge in the Indian tradition and in physics. So I propose to approach this topic, matter and religion, which refers to these two areas, because before converting to this wonderful world of Sanskrit and Indian philosophy, I was actually doing physics. So although a natural tendency here could be to kind of compare, let's say, what is matter in physics with what is matter, let's say, Nyaya Vaisheshika in these naturalistic metaphysical schools or Samkhya, I wish here to engage a perspective that appears at first sight radically different from that of physics, given its strong idealistic and otherworldly outlook, Advaita Vedanta. Mm. So let's be clear at the outset. So I don't intend to draw a clear parallel between both conceptions of matter. You have nothing like energy, field, quantum state, wave function, all these concepts that are so crucial to our understanding of matter in quantum physics today, they are not present in those systems, so there's nothing like a pure parallel here. The point of comparison I have in mind lies in the propedeutic function of the Advaita discourse on matter, on the one hand, and some philosophical implications of quantum physics, on the other hand. In Advaita Vedanta, as I'll briefly discuss, physical theory, what we could call physical theory, fundamentally aims actually at bringing one's attention back to being, to Brahman, whatever you call it, to the unity of being. And similarly, inquiry into matter in quantum physics since the first few decades can also lead away from matter, as it were, that's a big claim, in a sense, into deeper and necessary questionings about the nature of ultimate reality and the profound elusiveness of this reality, necessarily. So let's start with Advaita. So Advaita, you may already know, defends the view based on its exegesis of Upanishads. That's important. It starts from a certain scriptural tradition, certain metaphysical assumptions. So it just claims that everything is the one unchanging Brahman, the ultimate, transcendent, and immanent absolute. And the world appears to be plural, appears to change because of this creative and concealing power of Brahman called Maya. And the self we experience, the jiva, is also conceived to be non-different from Brahman. And it's not perceived to be as such because of our mistaken cognitions and because of a deep-rooted ignorance of things, avidya. Thus, there's a saying in Advaita, Brahma Sat... Well, I'll leave the Sanskrit out. So significantly, although the apparent reality of the world is a cardinal tenet of the school, Advaita still does pay attention to what is the physical world. That's an interesting thing in itself. The nature and the formation of these elements, what they call the bhutas, or the mahabhutas, the panchabhutas, so fire, very common, everyone knows about these fire, water, earth, air, and space, this akasha I did mention, which appear early on in the Upanishads. So according to Advaitins, the creation of the world from Brahman starts with Maya, and then from this Maya you have those subtle elements, subtle counterparts of these elements, the tanmatras, of these five, and then they combine together, giving rise to the gross elements, and these gross elements combine to form the world we experience. It's more or less the model they have. So there's a need in this system to account for the world we perceive and its fleeting reality. After all, the world for them is not illusory, but has an indescribable and transactional status. It is valid, really, epistemologically, until it is sublated by another, more profound experience, the knowledge of Brahman, paravidya, they call. So let's move to the models, the physical theory, how the subtle elements transform into those gross elements. Very easy. And one is called Trivritkarana, the other one is Panchikarana. So, keep an eye on the first A1. So in the Trivikarana, we have three elements, fire, water, and earth. They divide themselves, they recombine with each other in a way that the gross elements will be combinations of all the subtle elements, something like that. And the Panchikarana is just an extension of this process to the five elements. So why two models? It's a very simple question. Because of the Upanishads, because the Upanishads mention a list of three elements and five elements, so all the exegetes, all the commentators had to take this into account. So, coming back to Shankara, who is an important figure, or he is the most important figure in the Advaita Vedanta tradition, he does mention both theories, of course, in his work. In his Brahmasutra Bhashya, he mentions the Trivedkarana. In his commentary on the Chandogya Upanishad, he also mentioned the Trivedkarana and the Panchikarana in another work called the Upadesha Sahasri. Anyway, so does this mean that there's an internal contradiction within Shankara's system? Probably not. So now, A1. Well, I have one here. Yeah. So in while commenting on this Trivedkarana process, Shankara says, but just as in this Trivedkarana process, the truth is that there are three forms, three elements somehow. So also the same logic applies in the case of the Panchikarana. And the point is this, what he says after. Therefore, it becomes clearly established that since all things are modifications of being, sat, so when being becomes known, all this world becomes known. Mm. As in this statements, being is one without a second, so on and so forth. So the point I want to make, just here quickly, is that what is fundamental to Shankara is not the theoretical difference between these models, but their essential equivalence in leading to the same purpose, the realization of being as one without a second. He is not interested in upholding one theory over the other as the only valid process by means of which the universe of duality comes to existence. What matters for him is that by knowing being, of which matter is an apparent epiphenomenon, one knows everything. Of course, it doesn't mean you know all the quantum states of all the subatomic particles in the world or whatever. It just means that you know what is truly essential, spiritually speaking. Thus, accounts of creation in Shankara's system have the propedeutic function of drawing attention back to the unity of being and preparing one for the understanding and experience of this higher truth. Yeah, A2 is another example. It's a 14th century work, classic, Panchadashi, which devotes an entire chapter. You know, it's all about, we have it there, we have a couple of copies of the Panchadashi. It's all about Brahman, realizing Brahman, and so on. But there's still a chapter about the physical world. And there, at the beginning of it, the first verse of this section, called Panchabhuta Viveka Prakaranam, we are told that it's possible to realize the non-dual being thought in our scriptures based on a discrimination of the five elements, so the five elements are examined. Interesting. And the 16th century, Vedanta Paribhasha, someone says, okay, an objector, if Brahman is established by our text as the cause of the physical world, then Brahman must be inclusive of this manifestation. Otherwise, it would follow that our sentences, all these passages about physicality, about the creation of the world, would have no authority, would have no purpose. And the reply is, no. The sentence dealing with creation have nothing to do with creation, have nothing to do with the world. Really, it's all about Brahman. It's all about pointing to him. Yeah, so that's just a cue, just a hint of the way this school approached physical theory. So the main point is that these theories are not final explanations. They are just tools. They are just models whose purpose is not so much to describe the physical world as it is, as to point beyond it, as to indicate something else, Brahman in this case. So that gave me an idea. First of all, I think there's an interesting parallel to be drawn with the idea of the modern understanding of physical theories as models. It's not always obvious to people, to everyone, that physical theories are just models. Any theory, even if it's very correct within a certain domain, can still be superseded by a theory that just explains more things. So Newton mechanics works perfectly fine for normal life. But if you have an object that happens to reach a velocity that comes close to the velocity of light, then it fails, and Einstein's relativity comes. And Einstein's supersedes these theories. Well, and there's also a parallel, I think, in that models in physics can also have some sort of propedeutic function in another way, in their leading to genuine philosophical inquiry. So we normally take it that physical theories only aim or at describing the world as it is. So we have the scientists, we have the world, and there's a theory maybe in between. of course, philosophy is involved and so on. But with the advent of quantum physics, something, in my sense, historically speaking, something special happened in the first decades of the 20th century, and the subsequent work on this theory by philosophers of physics in particular. So since that time, it has become clear, I think, to physicists and philosophers that physics must deal with deeper problems. So topics that were traditionally confined to metaphysics, you mentioned a couple, and also to discourses about ontology, like causation, locality, continuity, distinguishability, part holes. Many of these concepts actually were tied to Newton mechanics in many ways, or Newton mechanics was a reflection of it. But with quantum physics, we were like, just, whoa, it doesn't work the way we planned at all. And all these concepts were challenged in significantly. And now they stand at the very center of the interpretation of quantum physics. So philosophers are there, and they try to understand what's going on. The world resists to our interpretation, as it were. So much so that some philosophers have argued that any tentative philosophical approach to a comprehensive view of the world should take information coming from physics very seriously. When you try to build a system, a comprehensive worldview, you need maybe to have a certain knowledge of physics, because physics has already challenged some of these common notions we had before. Some people argue like that. It is not that physics needs metaphysics. So this we already know. We already know that any physical theory relies on certain metaphysical assumptions, mechanisms of material constitutions, interactions, so on and so forth. But it's more that metaphysics needs physics. In other words, physics insights into the world of matter have become a very useful handle, maybe one that cannot be neglected for philosophers to reflect on what there is. So since time is short, and since we are not physicists, I'd like to draw your attention to a very nice phenomenon in physics called non-separability. Have you heard about it? Mm-hmm. A bit. So non-separability appeared in for the first time in a series of experiments conducted by the French physicist Alain Aspect in the 1990s. He must be still working on this. To put it simply, non-separability states that, okay, very simply, if you have two or more particles prepared in the same way together, they are in the same quantum state. So what happens is they are linked in such a way that the quantum state of one particle cannot be adequately described without full consideration of the state of the other particles, even if the particles are spatially separated from each other. So the correlated particles behave as if each particle is instantaneously aware of the measurement obtained on the other and adapts accordingly. So people, in common sense, we all, there's a transmission of information, so on and so forth. No. That's not possible. There's no transmission of information. This is something else. So we have to think differently about this problem. It really led philosophers to rethink the old problem of reality, propose new models of scientific realism that reevaluated the nature of reality disclosed through scientific knowledge. It also led philosophers to interrogate the inherent epistemological limitations of science in attempting to define what is real. Well, that far, just this experiment. So several interpretations of it have been proposed. The most accepted one is one in line with the Copenhagen interpretation. So Copenhagen interpretation is the most orthodox interpretation of quantum physics. It started with Niels Bohr in the 1920s when he was discussing with Einstein. They had wonderful debates, by the way, together, very different views. And so more or less it says that these particles I mentioned, they constitute before measurement a single correlated whole, entangled whole. Actually, we say particle, but the very concept of particle has disappeared more or less. And at measurement, we acquire knowledge, let's say, of this particle in Paris and infer that the particle in New York has such and such property. So the initial entangled whole collapses at measurement, and each particle acquires, as it were, its own individuality at that moment. Sounds pretty esoteric, but the implication is real. Individuality is no more an objective feature of reality, but a manifestation or a consequence of the observer's knowledge. It has nothing to do with consciousness. It's just about measurement, material device interaction, this kind of thing. So in recent years, there's a he died recently, a few years ago. He won this Templeton Prize, Bernard d'Espagnat. I've been very interested in his work. He was a student of Louis de Broglie in the 1920s, and he's also a philosopher of science. He worked on an interpretation called veiled realism. But leaving aside his interpretation, his work, his foundational work, is very interesting to look at. He worked just on inseparability. What he says is that this phenomenon implies, when you think about it, that the universe cannot fundamentally be constituted of separate entities. Okay? Because of that, we must first posit a concept of some sort of empirical reality, because actually we see things separately from each other. So if we hold to naive realism, according to which we apprehend things as they are, we cannot explain why, at the level of observable phenomena, everything occurs as if the universe was made of isolated parts. And at the same time, non-separability tells us that we have to introduce a concept of, let's call it ontological reality, that is not constituted of distinct parts. Now, coming to my point slowly, d'Espagnat and other philosophers have been quite hesitant to describe, to put in words, this ontological reality, except for saying that it accounts for our observation of non-separability, and that if we hold to naive realism, then we get results that experiment falsifies. Physical theories are models that deal with empirical phenomena, and as such, they cannot make cognitive claims about this ontological reality. The latter, this ontological reality, can only be described indirectly, negatively, not constituted of parts, not conceptualizable, this kind of thing. In other words, although ontological reality is implied by a specific experiment in physics, its full epistemic access lies beyond the scope of scientific inquiry, according to these philosophers, and most philosophers that have been looking at this. While d'Espagnat himself, he was maybe some sort of religious man, he personally believed we could get glimpses of this ontological reality, especially he was talking about the universal laws and so on, physics and mathematics. But most philosophers remain convinced that this realm will forever remain beyond the scope of scientific inquiry. In any case, what is significant for me is that d'Espagnat and others were compelled to take into account this ontological reality and reflect on its implications as physicists dealing with matter. Thus, physics too, I conclude, in its own way, can have a propedeutic function, that of pointing beyond itself to the essence of physical phenomena, to their underlying reality, in fact of revealing a domain that yet lies beyond the scope of scientific inquiry. In other words, that is transcendent. We talked about horizontality and verticality, so physics looks like something very horizontal, but there's a vertical dimension to it, I would say. Mm. So the crucial point is that this sort of questioning about the meaning of reality itself is no more a philosophical hobby, like that Einstein or others could just think through. It became a necessity, something that even hardcore physicists are bound to discuss. Matter, even in the most down-to-earth branch of science, physics, is not merely the stuff out of which the world is constituted. It is an object of investigation that has significant ramifications, I think, in the discourse of ontology today and religion, too. So that's the talk more or less.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.